Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On the second part of this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill concludes his conversation with Darrell Bradford, Executive Vice President of the education advocacy organization 50CAN. The two discuss the behavioral changes brought on by the global pandemic and how it portends for the future of public education. In a time of deep polarized tribalism, both believe the unbundling of public education services is a benefit for a pluralistic civil society. Can traditional, inflexible, large school districts and teachers' unions adapt to better serve families looking to unbundle their services? What will it take for other progressives to support a world of diverse education choice? Those questions and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
What seems to me to be very interesting is you guys are starting to put together infrastructure funded through federal dollars that begins to transition to a new public education system, one that really empowers families and begins to think about, in addition to money, which is obviously a critical part of power, they also need information. So diagnostic assessments, feedback assessments to help them make good choices for their kids. So power sort of comes from money and from information together. And you're starting to say, okay, let's think about that infrastructure moving forward, which is a game changer. But when the federal money runs out, I mean, that's when you get back to the war, right? So I'm wondering how you're thinking about that. I mean, you're a smart guy, so I don't want to out your whole strategy here, but it sounds to me like you're putting some things in place. Families are going to like this experience. There's going to be equity opportunities here because low-income families will also be able to participate in things like micro schools and learning pods and a local mom and a community. Is going to be able to actually support herself through being able to the facilitator of a 12 kid learning pod. And now suddenly she has a job at the small business she's building. Now you got economic development built in. So is this the master plan? I mean, am I close? Am I warm?
I know you didn't want to out it, but you outed it. Mark and I were talking about this and he described it as like a change in behavior. So like, there was a piece in the New York Times about how in Italy, right? So Italy is an old country and it doesn't have a ton of internet penetration, right? And it has a tradition of people shopping at local stores. And so Amazon has never had like a big market in Italy until now, right? And because there was a crisis, right? Like, you know, they have a huge logistical operation and whatever. And they were interviewing tons of people who were basically saying, I like this now. You know, I like being able to shop this way. I can get things that I wouldn't normally get. And that behavior can't be sort of undone. And, you know, a few years ago, it's probably like a lot of years now, I stopped counting. I gave like a TED talk about this because I really like music. And it's just like, there was the record store, and then there was Napster, and then there was iTunes, and then you just couldn't undo the behavior that Napster created, right? And the way you could get what you wanted, wherever you wanted, and the mixes you could make, and the flexibility, and the freedom, and the discovery of all that. Just the record store didn't meet that paradigm, you know. And so for us, like, we think that right now we're in a moment of behavior change, right? And there are a couple of things that accelerate or support that change of behavior. One of them is money, right? So the fact that some governors are very forward thinking and have been using gear dollars and that kind of stuff to promote this behavior is a good thing. You know, one of the other ones is counterintuitively the recalcitrance of school districts, right? Like in not offering a compelling option, like, people have to solve the problem themselves, right? So you're looking to a different person to solve the problem, and that's you know, and you're developing a new kind of behavior because of it. One of the third really important things is sort of like constituency. So we have, you do what you do, you do what I do, you care about the things we care about. We've been telling people that large urban school district bureaucracies are inflexible, and that inflexibility is most acutely visited upon low-income kids of color who don't have a lot of choices. And people are like, yeah, it can't be that bad. And now that same inflexibility is being visited upon millions of people who thought they bought their way out of that with an overpriced mortgage. And they're like, oh, man, it really isn't bad. You know, and so there are lots of people, I feel like, whose behavior is being changed right now that normally would not be under one of our normal policy assumptions. And those people are really important, right? They're important because they normally have their own money and they are more geographically diverse, and they have different voting habits than our core constituency does, right? So that's also a really important thing. And then I think the last part of it, and this is kind of hiding in plain sight, again, like the New York Times had a piece about this, which is when you knew it was starting to like kind of go the other way, which is that, you know, as bad as the era of poorly implemented remote has been for a lot of kids, because it has, some kids have really flourished, right? And the piece was, maybe some kids are better off learning at home, you know, which reminds me conversely of this piece that was in the Wall Street Journal. It was like a little editorial cartoon. It was two letters written in maybe like April, one from cat and one from dog. And the one from cat was like, we need to go back to work. And the one from dog was like, why can't you just work from home forever? So it was like really, really funny. But the fact that some people have discovered that it can be done differently, right? And, you know, in a lower stress way, or like in a different, in a way that has a different version of what good is, you know, or is accountable in a different way, right? Or, you know, maybe some parents, like our Colorado campaign talks about this a lot, you know, they've developed a very different relationship between themselves, their kid, and their learning, and they like that, right? There's just a different way it can be done now, you know? And all of those things together, I think, are difficult to unring in a way that helps you make a different public policy ask in the future, you know, which is like, state funds should do this. Like, you know, we should pay for this locally, or we should pay for it for all the kids who aren't here. To your point as well, though, I don't want to gloss over it because I thought you were spot on about this. For us, this is totally about equity, but it's about equity in a different way. So there are lots of people who want to rein in the top, right? So they're like, all those rich people doing pods, you know, whatever, like, forget it. A, you're never going to stop them from doing it, ever, right? B, the assumption of that is that you know, black folks, you know, brown folks, low income piece of folks of color have neither the expertise or the will to actually accomplish it themselves, and that's wrong. The only thing they don't have is the money.
Right.
And so for us, we're like, you know, particularly like you mentioned the learning pod thing, like the history of childcare in cities is entrepreneurial women of color, right? Who know their community and who've been doing this, right? And lots of public pre-K supplanted that or you know, pushed it away. Like, let's reinvest in that. We have an opportunity to do it. And to your point, there are economic knock-ons to all of that that would be wildly beneficial, especially when we think about, you know, states recovering from COVID, et cetera. So for us, like, this is a wonderful way to look at the future. There's still going to be people, much like you, you know, and have always argued, who are going to want their local option. Great, fine, go for it, you know. But there's an approach that's emerging now that a lot of other people really dig, right? Or seeming to dig. And I don't think we should be thinking about unringing that bell, even if, you know, if it's 10% of the people, great. You know, it's awesome. Like, it's 10% more than had access to that before, and that's a good thing.
So I want to ask you about school districts, because you mentioned them a couple times, and obviously there's enormous amount of resources tied up in school districts. A lot of wonderful people, you know, trying to do the very best in a system that is really difficult to work in.
Yeah.
You know, I know that very well. As you know, 15 years as a teacher union leader, it's a systems problem. It's not bad people. It's just really a dysfunctional system. Part of what I think is happening, and you're talking about it too, is sort of the unbundling of services. You know, in the past, it's been one-stop shopping. Your local school did everything for you. You know, childcare, academic, after-school, you know, care, et cetera. And now suddenly things are starting to break up. The pandemic is forcing unbundling of services. I'm wondering, Is there any hope at all that school districts will be able to evolve and be a little more flexible so that, you know, some of the good things that are coming out of this horrific pandemic can really help school districts become more flexible, more innovative, more thoughtful about unbundling their services and not trying to completely dominate all aspects of our lives?
Yeah, so two things, and the first one on unbundling, which is exactly the right word to describe it. Like, to me, the unbundling of some of these things is actually a vote for civil society. So the consolidation of these things, much like the pre-K argument, has actually pushed out other organizations that had these roles in the past. And given who we are as a political mind, as a nation right now, we need more mediating institutions supporting us, not fewer, right? So consolidation is actually the wrong thing to do. So like, you know, if the church can be back involved again, we should do that. If the community center can do the pre-K thing or the food thing, we should let them do that, right? But because we need the institution, not just the service. And other nations, like, I'm sure you know Mike McShane, you know, sure. It's like, so he was talking about how like in Ireland, the schools don't run sports, right? Everything is club, you know? Right. And so as much as, you know, high school football in Florida, I know if I say this out loud, they're going to come for me. But to the extent that we can think about those things, I think that's a good thing, because the knock-on effect is a civic one.
Yeah.
The second thing I would just say is like, all of the stuff you just said, true, right? Regulation, whatever, but very specifically finance, I think. So there's a point where things are so bad that you have to get out from under things like bloat, like, you know, legacy costs, right? Like your relationship with the pension fund, your debt service on buildings that are half full, right? Because at some point in the past you had 50,000 students, now you have 15,000 students, you know? Like all of those things are real, have been real, and some people, some really smart district leaders have wanted to get out from under them, but have not had the leverage to do so. And so to me, the mistake would be to superfund the old thing and essentially concretize its problems. Like now we could go back in and say, all right, look, you know, like in terms of pay or buildings or all these other things, like let's zero sum that and see what happens. Not as a way to blow it all up, but as a way to make sure it doesn't blow up, because the you know, you're starting to see these articles that are coming out right now where, like, I think this in Virginia, one of my bosses told me about this, you know, there's a local superintendent who's like, please don't disenroll your kid because we can't lose the money. And that same person sends their kid to private school now because they want an in-person option. I was like, what? It's like, what? Are you kidding me? You know, like that is just not a realistic context for everybody. And that just sends the message that even they know it's not sustainable. Yeah. You know, so I, you know, again, like, not to be ghoulish, there's an opportunity here to talk about how we make sure we continue to have public schools that are sustainable, you know, not continue to have a monopoly that isn't.
I think there's an opportunity to have a fascinating conversation, and hopefully it can be a broad conversation about the future of school districts.
Yeah.
You know, you do have all these buildings. You know, do they have to all be controlled and managed by a central government bureaucracy, or, you know, can you open that space up to entrepreneurs and local communities? And because there's all these resources there, but do they have to be organized in a command and control system, or can we do what you just said, which I thought was beautifully said, which is open it up and re-engage the community in a way that helps build civic infrastructure? You know, and you would think progressives would be all over that. But for whatever reason, in this particular space, as you know, they suddenly become, you know, power to the bureaucracy and, you know, not power to the people. I don't know why. I don't know what happens there.
Yeah.
But it seems like really, there's all these opportunities here.
It's really hard for me, too, because it's like, so I'm always like, I want parents to do what is in the enlightened self-interest of their own child, right? Sure. And I think it's a mistake to make public policy that requires you not to behave in your child's best interests, right? So because of where I am in the world, that like, you know, because how I'm a pretty centrist, but I vote in Democratic primaries still, you know, I view the world through that lens. I just can't figure it out, because it's like they have they're totally progressives, right? They are going to do what is best for their kid, right? If it's lie, if it's get test prep, if it's overpay for a mortgage, they're going to do it, right? To get the thing that works for them. But you absolutely can't do that, because it's important you stay in the other system so they feel good about it, right? And like, I can't reconcile that. That's like saying, you know, like, we got to have some racism so that these guys feel okay about themselves. You know, it's like, you either got to have some racism or none. I'm going to go on team none for this one. And so like, the goal should include functioning institutions.
Yeah.
The goal can't be to maintain the institution. And that is where I struggle with it too. I just can't get my brain to get why. And if I could get it, I would feel much more comfortable about it, but you know, whatever.
I'm a big believer in tribalism. I think it's part of our DNA. I think the people who aren't tribal got eaten by the saber-toothed tigers, and their
touché. Well said.
Their DNA is no longer part of the gene pool. So I think we're naturally tribal, and I think we're naturally, you know, want status within the tribe. We don't want to be thrown out of the tribe. And so right now, you know, if the primary funder of the tribe is teacher unions, and teacher unions, their business model requires a centralized command and control organization, because they collective bargaining requires a centralized command and control entity, and that's the main funder. And so suddenly people just automatically say, you know, no to choice, because that's the tribal position, and nobody wants to be thrown out of a cocktail party for saying, hey, maybe, you know, we should do something different. I think that's sort of what's going on. That's my armchair psychology.
Yeah, this is why I drink alone. I mean, this isn't specifically about education, but I think you've seen it in education policy. It's just like I was telling somebody the other day, the last like 15 years in America, right, have been an experiment in getting people hooked on polarization.
Yeah.
And all of the, like, our media, our social media, what Jonathan Haidt calls the sociometer, right, which is like how you think people perceive what you're doing at every given time, like that has shaped people who chase the high of having an enemy in the other tribe. And that is deeply destructive. And it is becoming like a veil that's sort of like impenetrable. And that's the problem, because like, we need people hooked on moderation, because moderation gives you solutions. You know, if your political strategy is a supermajority, that's a bad strategy, you know? And I don't know exactly how we work ourselves out of it. You know, for me, I'm going to stay focused on empowering individual people to solve their problems, right? Because they know themselves and their children best. And I'm going to continue to harken back to an era where people who didn't agree on things came together on small points of agreement to help people who needed policy wins, you know, like regular folks who don't spend their time in Tallahassee or in Trenton or in Albany, you know, trying to fix the world. And that's going to be my story, and I'm going to stick to it.
I'm hoping, you know, it feels like the Ed Choice movement ought to be able to bring people together. I mean, in Florida, we're going to have 150,000 plus kids on scholarship this year. Probably 75% of those are Democratic families. I mean, they're low-income families of color. So we have this strange situation where all the political heavy lifting is being done by Republicans.
Right.
All the beneficiaries are primarily Democrats, and yet the Democratic establishment is opposing it, at least in public. In private, they say, look, we get it. But, you know, hopefully, eventually, that should be an issue that brings both parties together, and it just feels like it ought to be there. You know, if we can convince the school districts to be a little more innovative, You know, there's no reason why teacher unions can't be helping teachers set up micro schools.
I totally agree.
I mean, that's a huge business opportunity. They're just lazy. They don't want to put down the remote control and get off the couch. You know, I mean, the business model right now is very lucrative.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's going to have to change eventually. And the sooner they do it, there's a chance to bring everybody together. So this could be the issue. Maybe I'm being Pollyannish. This could be the issue that really brings a lot of society together, again, around our kids. I mean, who doesn't love children? I mean, you know, so it seems like there's a possibility here. Maybe, again, I'm being overly optimistic, but.
Yeah, I subscribe to your optimism. And again, like you just to bring it all back, the important thing, the different thing right now is that the constituency is different. So like, however you want to say it, like politics responds one way to low income constituencies and another way to constituencies that are more diverse based on income, you know,
right.
And right now, like the latter is the constituency. And
right.
And maybe that is what helps, you know, helps us unite people around a new, more diverse, more interesting, more teacher friendly, more kid friendly, more parent friendly version of public education in America.